Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Few people think of North Carolina, or South Carolina for that matter, when they think of the American buffalo. Indeed, when most of us think about the American bison, we think of Yellowstone National Park. We think of lumbering beasts, snorting plumes of frost in snow-encrusted Wyoming or Montana. We think of the Old West. And many of us in North Carolina, including the Charlotte region, far from the Albemarle Peninsula, have no idea that 40 years ago, our home state became a living laboratory for restoring the population of red wolves. In fact, a five-county region in the eastern part of our state is the only hope for restoring the health and population of wild red wolves. Predators, large and small, near extinction, or long gone because of man-made mayhem of various kinds, are the focus of Andrew Moore's new book. It's called The Beasts of the East: The Fall and Rise of America's Eastern Wilderness, and it's just been published by Mariner Books. Andrew Moore joins us today to discuss North Carolina's role in what remains an often contentious debate over ecological and environmental policy and recovery. Andrew, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Eric, thanks so much for having me.
So I'd like to begin with how you approached this book. You traveled some 10,000 miles over 6 years tracing the history of these extirpated and endangered animals, principally elk, bison, and wolves. Why was it important for you to see the actual land where these animals live to explain this history?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm glad you started there because, the land is, and the land community is really what some of these stories became as I started digging into them and learning the stories of these reintroduction projects. In many cases, the reintroduction of these animals couldn't happen until the land was either secured or restored, or in some cases made public, in the case of the American red wolf. And, you know, if I was going to write about these animals and these stories, of course, I had to go to the places. I had to see the animals. I had to see the land where they had been restored. And so, yes, it did involve a lot of traveling to cover the eastern U.S. I was on the road quite a bit over those six some years.
And that included a 2,600-mile bike ride from Montana to New York. What was that experience like?
Yeah, that was so I kicked all of this off actually way back in 2017. I had a good friend of mine was planning to bike across the country. He was going to start in Seattle and end in New York City. And I had just received a grant to begin investigating this project, the Beast of the East. And so I thought, I knew I was going to leave my day job and start working on the book. And so I thought, well, this is an opportunity for, first of all, an adventure of a lifetime, biking across the country. And then also I knew it was going to be an opportunity to really intimately get to know the land, and see exactly how it changes when you go from the West, from, northern Montana to Indiana, to Illinois, to places that are no longer thought, Illinois, for example, is known as the Prairie State. And it's where the Tallgrass Prairie was this rich, beautiful landscape hundreds of years ago. And now it's largely agricultural or urban. And so I thought that biking through this country was going to be a good way to get to know all the peculiarities of the place and to really think about the challenges, right, of putting these big 2,000-pound animals back on the landscape in the case of the American bison. How can we do that in this domesticated East that we live in? And yes, it was a lot of fun, the trip, the trip itself.
I'm curious, did you see much in the way of wildlife as you're making your way across the country?
I saw a lot of tractor trailers. I saw
different kind of wildlife.
That's right. I saw a lot of loose dogs coming after me. You know, and thinking back, we saw, of course, we saw some deer. We saw lots of interesting roadkill. But much of the country that we cycled through was quiet. What was in fact either agricultural or rural, but wasn't teeming with the wild beasts of the old America, if you will.
You know, so many of us experience this country either by car, obviously, or airplane, where you're just flying over what feels like monotony. To be that close to the land and the way it changes and the topography must have been really helpful for you to put yourself in the mindset of what it was like way back when.
Absolutely. You don't take for granted even gentle rises in terrain when you're cycling. You know, land that you might say is flat. When you're pumping the pedals to get up and down these hills, you realize just how rolling and undulating the topography can be in places. And you can really feel when you're getting into new country, right? So like when you're leaving the plains of the Great Lakes and entering into the Allegheny Plateau, for example, you really feel how different of a country it is. And you notice when you're entering new ecosystems and landscape histories.
I'm curious, at what point did you know that you were going to focus on bison, elk, and the red wolf?
Yeah, so this book really started when I learned that the state of West Virginia was going to be reintroducing wild elk to the southern part of the state. And for me, I didn't know that elk were indigenous to West Virginia. So the thought of reintroducing, I thought, wait a minute, how do you reintroduce something that's not from there? But in fact, they were, you know, elk were indigenous to West Virginia. And I dug in and I learned that West Virginia wasn't even the first state to reintroduce elk in the past 20 years. You know, this all, the modern movement of translocating elk to Central Appalachia begins with East Kentucky in 1997. And shortly thereafter, I learned about this movement to put bison on recreated tallgrass prairie preserves in Illinois and Indiana. And I think in the back of my head, like many Americans, I had some sense that, you know, bison were around east of the Mississippi at some point, but I hadn't really thought about the degree to which they were really a part of the ecosystems of the East and for how long they had been in the East. So learning about these projects that were happening, you know, these weren't advocacy papers I was reading. These were news stories that were saying this is happening. And I wanted to know the history of that. You know, these things, as I explain in my book, they don't just happen overnight. You know, someone doesn't just say, wouldn't this be neat, and we do it. There are battles that are fought to make this happen. People devote their lives to making this happen. And those are the stories I tell in the book. And you asked about, you know, how I made the decision to frame the book around these species. I made the choice to write about animals that have been fully extirpated from the East. So that means fully extinct from a region. Every single elk that had ever lived east of the Mississippi was killed. Same with the bison and same with the red wolf. They were all killed. And, you know, it's one thing for animals to be reduced in number and then to experience a rebound slowly over time. It's another thing to take them out of the land for hundreds of years and then for a society to say, hey, let's put these things back. And for me, it was these examples of animals that were gone. And then collectively, folks decided, let's bring them back. That to me, I thought told a story, a dramatic story. And that's what attracted me to them.
That's the voice of Andrew Moore. His new book is called The Beasts of the East. So much of what you learned and what you're writing about is grim subject matter. Dwindling populations, often cruel human behavior that leaves animals and species devastated, as you just mentioned, climate change and the loss of connection with nature. And yet, in the book, you are hopeful in many respects. Why?
I'm hopeful because I've met amazing people who have dedicated their lives to these animals and to these ecosystems. And the work they've done, the work they've accomplished is nothing short of incredible and inspiring. I've been thinking about some of these places in the book. For example, Nechusa Grasslands is a tall grass prairie preserve in Illinois, where they've recreated 4,000 acres of the former tall grass prairie. And I've begun thinking about that as, I like to think of it as the most hopeful place in America. We all know the story, many of us know the story of the slaughter of the American bison in this continent. And we know how few there were at one point. The story that I wanted to tell was of putting things back together. And what they've done in Illinois at this preserve is like I said, it's one of the most hopeful things in America. They've not just put bison on a pasture, they've recreated entire ecosystems out there by assembling the pieces. You know, they're not inventing things and creating them in a lab. Or creating them from scratch. They're just putting the pieces back together and letting the species themselves sort out the ecosystem. And so it's the people, the work, and the places themselves, the landscape itself that I continue to draw inspiration from.
And I think what jumps out in the book and your reporting is that these are largely anonymous people. These are people who are not making a great deal of money. And as you say, these are people who are going through years and years of court battles, policy battles, and often coming up short, and they simply have to persevere.
Yeah, especially in the case of the American red wolf, it has been a constant struggle for the past 40 years. The folks working on the ground, you know, many of them U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees, they just keep their head down and have to do the best work they can, even when lawsuits tie up their work, even when there's court battles questioning the right of this work to continue and even questioning the right of this species to exist. They keep working and they persevere.
It's a little bit of a miracle story when you think about it, and maybe that's the hopeful aspect.
Yeah. And at the same time, what I think the conclusion I've come to and you know, the story I tell in the book is that, you know, I don't try to sugarcoat it. You know, these animals like the red wolf, like the elk, and the ecosystems they belong to, whether it's the mixed mesophytic forest of the Appalachian Plateau or whether it's the Pocosin swamps of the Albemarle Peninsula, these things will only continue to exist if we want them to. You know, these are their continued existence is going to be assured only if the American people want them to exist. And so that's something I also hope comes across, is that these are outcomes that are in our hands.
Well, I can tell you that this interview is very much in our hands, but we have to take one quick break and we'll come back. We'll have much more with Andrew Moore on The Beasts of the East. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Andrew Moore, who writes about the environment and nature. His new book is called The Beasts of the East. Andrew, I want to go back to my opening remarks. I mentioned bison once roaming North and South Carolina. Can you help fill in some of the blanks of the landscape in the Carolinas at that time and when it began to change?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, North Carolina, we wouldn't ever, and South Carolina, we wouldn't ever really think that it looks like the American West, you know, the Great Plains. And yet it's clear that we had bison in this part of the country. We know that from, we find their bones. We know that because the settlers, when they came to this place, they wrote about them. They described them in vivid detail, encountering these animals in the Carolinas. And you know, we can have a pretty good idea of what the landscape might have looked like by listening to these accounts from the 1500s, 1600s. And one of the things that comes through when I was going through these old accounts is these descriptions were pretty clear. They actually used words like savanna to describe much of the Carolinas. And they use that often in conjunction with scenes of buffalo or bison. And they describe finding these animals in those savannas, in these sort of openings along rivers and creeks. So that is part of the story is realizing that not only were these animals here in the East a long time ago, but they were in a wild East that looked a bit different than maybe what we think of as wild Carolinas.
As we mentioned in your book, you concentrate on elk being reintroduced in Kentucky, bison in Illinois and Indiana, and the red wolves here in North Carolina, principally eastern North Carolina, which you visited. The story of trying to bring back red wolves in five counties along the Albemarle Peninsula is complicated, as you mentioned. Perhaps you can provide some context on why this was considered a good place to try this.
Yeah, so when the red wolf was found in Southeast Texas and Southwest Louisiana in the 70s, it was languishing. When we realized that this species even existed, when we discovered it down there, we quickly realized that there were so few of them left that if we didn't do something soon, they would go extinct. And they would go extinct because they were being killed, and they would go extinct because the population was being subsumed by the eastward expanding coyote population. So there were so few red wolves, and they were breeding in with coyotes, and they were soon going to be gone. And after trying to save them on the landscape down there, the Fish and Wildlife Service decided the best thing to do would be to put them into a captive breeding program to take them out of the wild to ensure they didn't vanish, and then try to find somewhere further east where there were not any coyotes, where they could release them, and try to build up a new core population of red wolves before the coyotes came east. And they tried to find a place for these wolves, and it was very hard. You know, we know that to this day, the reintroduction of wolves is a polarizing topic. And it was no different 40 years ago when we were looking for a place to put the wolves in the East. We tried and failed to put them in the Land Between the Lakes area in western Kentucky, western Tennessee. The folks there didn't want it to happen for a number of reasons. But eventually, after 6 years in captivity and after about 10 years of the captive breeding program, a landscape came up. The Fish and Wildlife Service had received a donation of a sprawling landscape in Northeast North Carolina from the Prudential Insurance Corporation.
This is an unreal story.
It really is. And it's this long saga that is just fascinating. This peat mining saga gone wrong in Northeast North Carolina, and this farming saga where, you know, folks were trying to drain tens and hundreds of thousands of acres of Pocosin wetlands and swamps to convert to agriculture, and the land won eventually. It just proved too difficult, and the damaging effects of draining that land. You know, it was going to pollute dramatically degrade the estuary, the fishing and the crabbing industry of the Albemarle Sound. And so, it's a long story, but eventually this land gets donated to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And no one at that time within that project had any thought that this was going to be a place to put the wolves. This was a project that this land itself, the Albemarle Peninsula properties that the Fish and Wildlife Service came into, had intrinsic value as this ecosystem that occurred in few other places in the world, and the diversity and value of this landscape was value in and of itself. Migrating songbirds, the northernmost population of the American alligator occurred there around the Alligator River. Incredible plant species, red-cockaded woodpeckers occurred on this landscape, so other endangered species were there. So this land came into the Fish and Wildlife Service, over 100,000 acres. And that's when the folks working on the Wolf Project saw that and said, hey, this is it. We're about as far east as we can get. We're basically in the Atlantic Ocean, meaning we're far from those Western coyote populations. This is a big landscape. And there were very few people on this peninsula compared to the rest of the state, compared to the rest of the East. So the idea of human wolf conflicts, they hoped would be low. So they found this landscape and they thought it was going to be, well, at the time, I think the word they used was a godsend, that this came across, and they got it off the ground. And that's where eventually the red wolf reintroduction began in 1986.
That's the voice of Andrew Moore. His new book is called The Beasts of the East. And I believe the current population is around 30 red wolves or so, although there was a period when they were really flourishing. What was that earlier success based on, and what's caused the decline in population?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it is quite low now. But 15 years ago, we had a red wolf population that was about as high as the wolves in Yellowstone National Park. We had over 100 animals on the landscape. And getting to that number was not always easy. We talked about moving east to get away from the coyotes. Well, guess what? They arrived in eastern North Carolina. So this problem, this hybridization problem that the biologists were running from, it found them, and it showed up, and they found workarounds and attempted solutions. So one of the things they did was, if a coyote found its way into the red wolf zone, and say a larger male coyote was paired up with a smaller female red wolf, well, the biologists in the program would actually trap the male coyote, sterilize it, and allow it to stay on the landscape. They call this a placeholder coyote. So it meant that no other coyote was going to come in and then breed with this female red wolf, but eventually a male red wolf, a bigger, badder wolf, would come in and either kill that coyote or run it out, and then would be able to then breed and establish a territory with the female red wolf. So that's just one example of the lengths the Fish and Wildlife Service was going to ensure this population. And again, it was working. And then around 2011, so at the peak of the population.
Which got up to what, around 200, something like that?
Yeah, something around there. Like I said, one biologist who had worked on this program as a researcher recently told me, and I'm just re-emphasizing this, is there were as many wolves in the Albemarle Peninsula as there were out in Yellowstone National Park. And eventually this sort of success story hit some stumbling blocks. There was at that time this sense that coyotes had sort of taken over North Carolina, and they had become this problem that people needed to deal with. And so landowners and even recreational hunters who enjoyed the pursuit of coyotes started hitting coyotes pretty hard. And the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission decided to liberalize the take of coyotes, meaning they legalized the night hunting of coyotes, including in this Albemarle Peninsula area, the five county area where the red wolf was. And as you can imagine, this was a problem for this endangered species on the edge of the continent there. And the gunshot mortality, so the gun, you know, shooting of red wolves skyrocketed around this time. I think there was one data point I saw that was it increased 275% around that time. And you know, when you've got a finite number of animals running around, if they start getting killed rapidly, that's not good for the population. Among the problems of this was that then it meant that more wolves were pairing with coyotes, because again, it was the same problem they had in Louisiana and Texas 40 years ago, that they were running out of mates.
I was going to say, one of the things that's so interesting, and you detailed this in the book, for us city dwellers, myself, may be guilty of not thinking about this enough, but the perception and the myth simply of coyotes and wolves drives so much of the policy and the behavior, the destructive behavior and unnecessary behavior in exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it is a construct, right, of wolves and the problem, this idea that it is a problem, or the problem of coyotes that needs to be solved, and that we can't share the landscape with them. Part of the downfall of the program around 2011 and in leading up into around 2020 was this idea that the coyotes who had come in from the West, and the wolves as well, were decimating the deer population. That because these predators had been reintroduced and had come in from the West, in the case of the coyotes, hunters were not going to have any deer. And hunters had worked really hard to build up these deer populations over the 20th century. And in come these predators, and if they're allowed to be on this landscape, we can't have deer anymore, or the numbers are going to be so low that hunters are going to go out and they're not going to be able to find deer. But when you look at the hunter harvest data, we were harvesting more and more deer every year with the rise in the wolf population. Hmm. So the deer harvest in the Albemarle Peninsula peaked with the peak of the wolf population. And now I'm not saying necessarily that the wolves were causing there to be more deer, but what I'm saying is there were plenty of deer on the landscape, and that this idea that we had to get rid of coyotes, or that we had to made a mistake in reintroducing red wolves, didn't match what the data was telling us about the number of deer on the landscape.
And I think analogous to the myth and the urge, the destructive urge to kill predators, you also are making the point throughout the book that Americans simply have a reluctance to understand the value of predators in nature. Thumbnail sketch, what is that value?
Yeah, so the thumbnail sketch is that predators, and that includes us as human hunters, but that the predation on animals like deer, like elk, keeps their numbers in check, so to speak, keeps them from being overabundant. And that when you take a look at natural areas throughout the East, what we tend to see is that we actually have too many deer for the landscapes, in the sense that a lot of our more pristine natural areas, or natural areas that are more like a historic ecosystem, with so many deer on the landscape, the deer are over-browsing a lot of the native plants, and leading some plants to local extirpation because there's so much deer. So on the one hand, what we have is a constituency who wants more deer in more places and no natural predators. And then we have ecosystems that are telling us something different, that we have too many of these ungulates, too many deer, too many animals doing the, you know, eating plants, that we actually need more predation. Now, whether that's wolves or panthers or humans, you know, I think we still have to decide what that looks like. But I think the thing we don't have, I don't think we can say we have too much predation in the East.
So a big part of this is simple lack of knowledge or lack of understanding of why these policies and these restorations make sense.
Yeah, that's part of it. The other thing that has to happen is we have to do a better job of explaining to each other the values of these animals. And when I say explaining to each other, you know, that could be the Fish and Wildlife Service explaining to local people in the Albemarle Peninsula the value of wolves. But if we're going to have, you know, we have a segment of society that does value predators, you know, and often we see that some of these folks are clustered in our cities. And, you know, whether it's Charlotte or Pittsburgh, where I live, or Denver, Colorado, you know, where they've in Colorado, they've voted to introduce wolves to the state of Colorado. I think the people who are, you know, it's a reductive term, but, you know, pro wolf or pro predator, have got to also get to know their rural neighbors, learn why these folks might not want, whether it's red wolves or coyotes or gray wolves in Colorado, learn what the problems are, and then try to work together. You know, in some ways, this is reflects the broader divisions we have in the country, where we're polarized, we're not listening, we're not talking to each other. But in the case of wildlife, the only way forward, you know, with animals like wolves, even animals like elk and bison, which have their own controversies and conflicts, we've got to listen to each other and find solutions that we can, that sit well with all of us, but also that conserve these animals and make sure that they're going to persist into the future.
We want to make sure that you're still listening, so stay with us right through the break, and we'll come back with much more on The Beasts of the East with author Andrew Moore. This is Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Andrew Moore, who writes about the environment and nature, and his new book is called The Beasts of the East. Andrew, one of the things I'm curious about is, what are some of the similarities and contrasts between the approach taken with the red wolf here in North Carolina compared with what was done with elk in Kentucky and bison in the Midwest?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that, because I chose these three animals as topics because in my way of telling the story, they told three very different stories. And all of the stories together tell the story of conservation in the eastern U.S. over the past 100 years, the 20th century of conservation. But they represent different things. So the elk in East Kentucky, that project to reintroduce free-roaming elk in East Kentucky, it is a bold project. When it was first proposed, you know, folks thought it was a wild, crazy idea to reintroduce these massive, near 1,000-pound animals to the coal fields of East Kentucky. Folks in the region hadn't thought about that. You know, they didn't even know elk were part of their past. Most people did not, that is. But that project was sold as a project for hunters that was going to be paid for by hunters, and this was a game species. This was this animal was being brought back to provide an opportunity for sportsmen and sportswomen, and in many ways the way I've begun to think about that project was it was kind of the last hurrah, the last big early 20th century translocation project. So in the early 20th century, fish and game departments were really, you know, getting started, and that's their roots are all in the early 20th century in the East. And many states were reintroducing deer because they had killed almost all of the deer out of the state, or, you know, certain regions of the state. And this project in Kentucky, in East Kentucky, to move elk into the state, was really more similar to those early 20th century projects. You know, it was we're going to stock an animal for sportsmen to hunt. Now this in it and that is a you know an American tradition. The North American model of conservation was founded with projects just like that. You know, we're going to have this animal, we're going to take care of this resource, and we're going to have it for generations to come as a consumptive resource that we're going to be able to kill, eat, consume, and perpetuate. We're going to take care of this resource. Whereas the bison in Illinois and Indiana is a very different story in that this is not a project for sportsmen. This is not a project for hunting. The bison that were introduced to these nature preserves in Illinois and Indiana were brought there because they were thought of as ecosystem engineers, that their grazing was this ecological disturbance that was necessary for the function of these prairies in Illinois and Indiana. So they weren't brought by the game department. They were brought in by the Nature Conservancy, and they were brought in as much as anything as a tool, the same way you might have someone use prescribed fire to manage a woodland or a meadow in the Carolinas. That's the job of these bison. So they were brought in and they're fenced. So they're not free roaming. They don't have that wild agency that the elk do in East Kentucky. So the Kentucky elk are hunted, they are consumed, but they are wild and they make their own decisions about their lives in East Kentucky. Whereas the bison, they are not consumed, but they're also not truly wild. You know, they are on these fence preserves and they are providing a job for the nature preserve. And the wolf, finally, the wolf is different than both of those in that it is completely wild and we don't consume it. You know, we the so it in some ways for me, it represents this sort of pinnacle of ecological conservation in that we go to great lengths to bring it back. We go to great lengths to ensure the population can thrive, but we're doing it for the benefit of the animal and for the benefit of the ecosystem. And in many ways, you know, we're not going in and consuming that animal. We're not, you know, we can admire it and we do derive things from its presence, but it's not the same as a game species. And it's not the same as a fenced bison in the sense that we're in control. That wolf goes wherever it wants to go. It goes onto private lands and it gets into trouble. Whereas, of course, the bison we control with fences.
That's the voice of Andrew Moore. His new book is called The Beasts of the East. And one of the things that struck me as you were answering that question, it reminded me of something else in the book that I found really fascinating. And that is, you just mentioned the traditional mode of conservation in America has been sportsmen and sportswomen paying and taking an active role in bringing back an animal or preserving an animal. And you mentioned the idea of perhaps finding another source of revenue or other sources of revenue to help with this. For example, maybe putting fees on bird watchers and other kinds of nature enthusiasts. And it hasn't taken hold yet, but the idea makes a lot of sense when you stop and think about it. What else might be tried or have people given up?
Yeah, I don't think that people have given up, but I just think taxes aren't popular. I think the term that was used some years ago was a backpack tax, right? So folks who hunt and fish pay an excise tax on, say, guns and ammunition. This is something the manufacturers pay, and that money goes to support fish and game agencies across the country. This is incredibly popular amongst the sporting traditions. And like you said, it pays for wildlife management areas. It pays for the salaries of the state wildlife biologists. And so when someone who hunts or fish says that, you know, their activity pays for conservation, they're absolutely right. And in the year 2026, you know, some of the fiercest public land defenders, for example, are coming from that constituency, folks who hunt and fish. But there's a lot of Americans, and in fact, there's more Americans who don't hunt and fish. And those folks deserve a seat at the table in terms of figuring out what conservation policies are, you know, which species get to live and which species we're gonna, you know, not conserve, for example. And if those folks want an equal seat at the table, you know, money talks. And I think if the it there's got to be we've got to think harder about that, you know, and maybe it is time for some more other kinds of funding for conservation. And again, that's not to say that there are non sort of non-consumptive nature lovers. You know, people pay in all kinds of ways. You know, they might give money to the Nature Conservancy or to the Audubon Society, and those agencies and land trusts do a lot of great work to protect, but to protect land and to protect species. But as a whole, I think it is well over time to think about other ways of funding conservation.
Now, in the book, you summarize the plight of the three primary animals that we're talking about. You write, quote, "Bison, like elk and red wolves, need more than anything to live not as showpieces behind fences, nor as genetically manipulated attractions," end quote. And you write also, quote, "What the red wolf needs today more than anything is land to live upon, where humans are not shooting them and vehicles are not so frequently striking and killing them," end quote. And here is what I thought about, not only with that summary, but throughout the book. Why do you think it has been so difficult to figure this out in a country where more and more of the population is clustered in cities? It seems like we would have more rural area than ever to make this work.
Yeah, well, we're clustered in cities, and then we're also sprawling out in our suburbs, right? So, I mean, I think North Carolina might be the fastest growing state. Maybe I think they just might have surpassed Florida,
Was going to say, we're
which
always
is,
in the top five every time, so yes.
yeah. And, you know, so, you know, rural landscapes, you know, whether it's farms or forests, they're converting into to housing and strip malls and data centers and distribution centers at an alarming pace. And they're not making more land, right? Isn't that the old expression? And we've only got so much land. And so yeah, we're clustering in cities, but our cities are sprawling ever outward. And I think, you know, sometimes it's just a really simple explanation, and that's it. There's a whole lot of us out there, and we're using up more resources and more land all the time. And you know, I think we can have great cities, and I think we can have great natural areas too. And you know, we've just got to work a little harder on figuring out how to accomplish that.
You mentioned in the book, and you've mentioned here, that we as a nation have often treated bison like cattle. As you say, they're not free even the restorative areas. They're not really free. I guess in Yellowstone and some other places they are, but for the most part, they are not. And then we have the elk as game, as you mentioned, in Kentucky. As people think about potentially bringing bison farther east and elk farther east, how likely do you think that is? In other words, could we see bison in North or South Carolina again at some point?
You know,
Beyond
if you had
farms?
to, yeah, if I had to give an answer right now, what do I think? I honestly think the answer is no. I don't, and I'm happy to be wrong. I don't think we're going to see wild free roaming bison in North Carolina or Pennsylvania, where I live, anytime soon. I think we're having a hard time even seeing free roaming bison in the West. You know, the American Prairie Reserve was trying to graze, or you know, put their bison that they technically quote unquote own on some public lands out there, and that has proven controversial. So even in the West, where we're supposed to have all this land and all this public land, we have a hard time allowing bison out there on the range. So the thought of doing it in the densely settled East is kind of hard to picture, but so was the thought of elk 20 years ago when Kentucky started saying we're gonna have a herd of 10,000 elk in East Kentucky, and they're just out there. They're on the landscape, and they cause some problems. The elk do, the free roaming elk in Kentucky, but you know, it's also just fine in other ways. You know, the sky hasn't fallen, and we're coexisting with these massive beasts. You know, bison are different from elk, but if we can do elk, it, you know, maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, and we could see it. No matter what happens, it's not going to be a return to the 1600s. If bison have a future in the East, it's going to look like something totally different than it has ever looked like, because this is, you know, we've remade the continent. You know, it looks very different here than it ever has in the past. So that's, I guess that's where I'll leave it is, you know, I'm hopeful for a future where all of the native animals and plants and birds and, you know, everything else has a place in the East. And it will be interesting to see, if it even happens in my lifetime, what it actually looks like to have this wild East again.
We've had some success with the red wolf, as you mentioned, in North Carolina, and things have gotten better since the night hunting was reversed and some other steps were taken. You also write about an attempt to do something similar in Western North Carolina and in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It did not work. Why did it not work?
It did not work for similar reasons that it did not work in the 2010s in Eastern North Carolina. Okay, so what do I mean by that is the wolves, the federal government sort of promised local landowners that the wolves would stay on federal property. And for a while, they did a slightly better job of that in Eastern North Carolina. But in Western North Carolina, in the Smoky Mountains, the forest was so dense and mature, and most of the wild prey was on private property. The deer, for example, were on private property in Western North Carolina, and the wolves went for the food. That's what they do. So they went to private property in Western North Carolina, and it didn't seem like there was going to be a future for where the wolves would stay on the national parklands in Western North Carolina. There were some other problems with viruses in the Western North Carolina. The, you know, pups were dying. But when you really kind of zoom out and look at it, that was the big problem out there. And so when you, again, take a even, you know, one more step back, when you look at it, the issue is we don't allow wolves. We have a hard time accepting that wolves are part of the Eastern biota, that they are part of the Eastern ecosystems. And so a lot of folks, in particular in rural areas, who have to coexist with the animals, like I said, you know, it's easier maybe for you and I in our cities to accept the idea of wolves because we're not tasked to live with them. But for some of these communities, the thought of having the wolves on their private property is just, you know, that's the they can't, it's hard to accept. Even though we accept every other species on private property, you know, a deer is on your property. We understand that deer doesn't belong to us, that we accept that it's on our property. You know, everything from alligators and black bears, all of that we accept. But the wolf has been a problem. And this recovery program for the red wolf, to get it off the ground, you know, we made promises. And when I say we, I mean the federal government made promises to local landowners that the wolf would stay on these federal properties. And those promises, we've kept them to varying degrees of success. But that is where a lot of the conflict lies, is this expectation for how a wolf is going to behave. And of course, a wild wolf wants to survive, and it's going to go where the food is.
That will have to be the last word. Andrew, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. It's a pleasure.
Andrew Moore's new book is The Beasts of the East. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.